everyone. Welcome to the 356th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we have a lot of news for you today. We are going to be talking a lot about chips. So not chips and dip, but things like the ARM NVIDIA deal, some legislation coming out of Congress, and really what's happening with the chip shortage. Plus, we have new chips to talk about. Silicon Labs has introduced something new. We've got a Google dev board for TinyML and a new board that might compete with Arduino. And plus, it's RISC-V. Woo! All right, if all that's too nerdy for you, we're also going to be talking about Peloton and their production plans, funding for two smart tracking startups, one on the personal side, one on the more enterprise-y side. And we've got some new smart home devices, or rather some reviews and new devices. So we've got an update on the Wemo stage, plus Philips Hue has launched some new products. And because we think y'all are awesome, we're also going to talk to Oisin Hanrahan, who is the CEO of Angie. You may be more familiar with Angie as Angie's List, but Angie just did a survey that found that some of the biggest home improvements in people's homes right now is smart home updates. It ranked number 3. So we're going to talk about that, and we're also going to hear from him about what the trades want from IoT device makers. All this and more awaits you. But first, let's hear from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Hologram, and more tracking, y'all. So Escavox and PureFetch are two IoT asset tracking companies, and they are monitoring the shipping conditions of fresh food from farm to customer and using Hologram as their connectivity partner. This means their devices stay connected no matter where they are in the world. So to learn more about how Escavox and PureFresh use Hologram's global SIM to keep food fresh, visit hologram.io/Stacy on IoT, and you can download your copy of the case study today. That's hologram.io/Stacy on IoT. Oh yeah, tracking super hot right now. So let's get into it, because you know what else is hot? The FTC and the DOJ and their concerns about antitrust. Woo! We talked about it last week, and it looks like this week, concerns about antitrust, not just here in the U.S., but honestly in the EU and even China, have been looking at NVIDIA's $40 billion bid for ARM, and they're saying, no, thank you. And now—
Are you surprised?
No, this was a crazy deal. And yep. ARM's customers were coming out against it. They were like, no, thank you. So this deal was announced in 2020. And NVIDIA said, you know what? We're going to buy ARM. And we all went, what? And part of this was SoftBank, which owns ARM, really needed to free up some cash. We'll just be honest. This was a, oh, let's throw ARM on the market because we need money. And we were all crazy shocked and kind of confused, and we didn't think it was a great deal, but whatever. And now, given the backlash against big deals in tech and the fact that many of ARM's own customers were like, no, ARM needs to stay a neutral player in the chip world, plus all the attention in the chip world, like with chip shortages and all this, even though that doesn't really have anything to do with this deal, in politics, appearances can be important. And I think that's what this is all about. So Bloomberg is reporting that NVIDIA is quietly preparing to abandon its purchase. So this isn't finalized, but NVIDIA is telling its partners it doesn't anticipate the transaction to close.
Yeah, and honestly, they had to know that this would face big headwinds. They also, I'm sure, are hearing whispers about if this would be approved or not. You know, that's all hush-hush behind the scenes stuff, but every company has people in the right places to understand what's going on at the regulatory level. For people who may not quite understand why this would be an issue, this may not be the best analogy, but I'm going to give it anyway, and you can tell me it stinks or whatever. It's kind of like, I don't know, let's say Eero, a maker of wireless routers, decides to somehow buy the Wi-Fi alliance that makes the wireless standards. It's kind of like that because ARM architecture is a very centralized organization They license out the architecture and designs for ARM chips. They improve those designs every year. And then anybody who wants to use those chips, and there are many people, many companies all around the world, then can, depending on the license they have, tweak that design or just use that designer out of the box and make chips for phones, tablets, TVs, anything, IoT devices, obviously. It's just, yeah, it has to be separate under this kind of model where there's this centralized intellectual property.
I agree with you, although I would say it's more like Korbel, the cheap champagne company, coming in and buying up all the vineyards in Champagne, France. So in the Champagne region of France. So to me, ARM is all the champagne grapes, right? So anybody can come in and use their designs. And if Korbel popped in and bought all those grapes, then not everybody who wanted to make champagne could make them anymore. They'd have to make sparkling wine.
And in your analogy, Korbel could keep the best grapes for itself.
Yes.
And its partners, quote unquote partners, that not licensed grapes, but maybe purchase them or use them, would not get the best.
Exactly. And they would have to compete against Korbel. So
exactly.
This is it. Everyone is like, really, Stacy? Korbel?
Stacy needs a glass of champagne right now, if you can't tell.
I'm being dry for quite some time, but, you know, one day. Okay, so that's what's happening with that deal. All of this is playing out, though, in the story of 2021 and still 2022, which is the chip shortage.
And 2023, I suspect.
And, oh, I was like, are we already in 2023? Did I miss 2022?
No. I think this is, people are underestimating the real challenge here.
I agree with you. So, some news on this front, on the federal side. The Biden administration has been pushing for the CHIPS Act, which is a financing, it's money and programs that would help boost the U.S.'s competitiveness in the semiconductor manufacturing industry. And this is all a little interesting because what's happened with the chip shortages, we've seen, obviously, huge shortages of chips. And it's affected mostly the government is worried about cars because auto manufacturing, and that creates a lot of jobs, it creates a lot of money. It's a big deal. So automakers have slowed their production or halted their production of some of their vehicles because they can't find enough chips. It's also affected companies all the way down the stack, like, you know, all the IoT companies. And it's basic chips. Like, some of them are like things you and I might think of, like, oh, Wi-Fi chips were in short supply for a while. That's a big deal. But it's also things like components, like power management chips, and I just all those little things that you don't think about on a piece of silicon. So it's causing all kinds of delays, and it's actually causing kind of a rethinking of how the industry works at a bunch of different levels. So companies like Apple are now paying chip suppliers for guaranteeing chips to them so they can push out enough phones.
That's actually been their standard operating procedure for years. So that's why they typically are least affected, and they get the newest, latest generation of chips. They prepay so these companies can build out foundries and production lines to make this, you know, whatever the next big thing is.
Yeah, because Apple understands that its products don't go anywhere without silicon, right? Everyone else is suddenly realizing this. I feel like they're coming to this conclusion. So GM and Ford both signed agreements with a couple chip companies to design chips for their vehicles and also to guarantee a supply. And the chip suppliers have been asking for this for a while because historically what's happened is they just produce goods and then the third-party manufacturers that build the components for cars buy them. Maybe, you know, other companies will come in and buy them. You might have a contract with like a DigiKey or Avnet or some kind of distributor just to buy boards. You know, the supply chain is not very transparent for most buyers of chips.
Not at the level, not at the high level of the people making the final end product.
Yes. So what the chip suppliers would like to see is everybody tell them, I would like X million chips for 2022. And then they can then build out capacity. So some other things to know. Building out capacity for silicon plants is crazy long. These are big, massive facilities. They have a lot of very high-end equipment. It costs a lot of money to build them. For example, Intel just announced a plant. They're going to build a fab. That's what they call their plants in Ohio. But this isn't going to be online until 2025. Samsung announced one in Texas. Again, not going to be online for a couple years. The other thing to know is these plants that we're lauding right now as being super awesome and going to, people feel like they're going to solve the problem, are actually not going to solve the problem. Nope. Because these plants are building, like, don't know if what nanometer Intel's building for at this particular facility, but they're building at like 7 nanometers and 11 nanometers and really high-end chips. Those are not the chips that are necessarily in demand. The types of chips that are in demand are usually built at like 10-year-old fabs, maybe even 15-year-old fabs. And this is where securing and understanding the supply chain is really going to matter, because if you're a chip manufacturer, you don't want to keep investing in this old stuff unless you know people are going to want it. And if you don't know it, you're kind of like, well, I need to keep upgrading to the latest thing. And that costs literally billions of dollars. So that's, we're at a kind of impasse here. And so the Commerce Department, getting to our news this week, asked for information about the CHIPS Act is proposing $52 billion for funding for domestic semiconductor production. And if this happens, the things they're asking for are, hey, we're going to build R&D platforms. We're going to figure out how we keep more production here in the U.S. because many of our fabs are over in Taiwan and Asia. And the Department of Commerce wants to know, hey, what should some of these programs that we're going to build with this $52 billion look like? They're like, should we build a national semiconductor technology center? Ooh, where should it be? Do we need to focus on package manufacturing? So after the chips are manufactured, you actually have to package them up to put them on boards. There's more, and a lot of times that happens in China. So you might have your high-end chip that's made here go over to China, get packaged, popped on a board, and come back. And then what kind of workers do we need?
Those are all good things, but they don't resolve the root cause of the problem, which is proper demand forecasting.
Yeah, predicting demand forecasts. And, you know, I get it. It's hard. If you're used to going to the grocery store and just picking up what you need, like every night to make dinner, for example, and then suddenly someone's saying, hey, you know what? Now we're going to switch to a model where you pre-order all of your groceries for the next month so we can make sure we have enough supply for you. That's a big shift. And that's kind of where these guys are. And all the new fabs in the world are not going to solve the underlying problem. They're good, but they're not going to solve the current shortage we have today. All right. But sure, let's throw $52 billion at the problem. You know what? I'm a chip girl. If you want to fund innovation in semiconductors, I mean, there's so many cool things we could do with like new materials to make them more energy efficient. I mean, chips, I'll just, my little chip rant. Chips are the heart of everything we do in computing. You cannot do anything without silicon. And yes, software is important, yes. But like the speeds, the actual physics of this that we're all working under, it's all based on silicon. Okay. Speaking of, I'm like, y'all, it's why it's so glorious to know.
I was going to chime up with software, but you cut me off preemptively there with the comment.
You totally need software. But
I know.
What does the software live on? It's like a chicken and egg thing, right? They both go together.
You're right.
But the chips are more important. Okay.
Well, let's talk about new chips then.
New chips. Silicon Labs. They have unveiled a brand new chip. We're really excited because it is, woo! Silicon Labs has unveiled new chips, and they are Matter ready. They are also popping little accelerators or coprocessors on there to handle AI and ML applications. Ready? Say it with me. At the edge.
I knew it.
So this is a really big deal. So we've got Bluetooth, we've got Matter, we've got Wi-Fi, all of that's on this board. And then you've got this coprocessor who's like, yeah, I'm going to handle all your AI ML needs. Pretty sweet.
And for the Zigbee fans, there's Zigbee support as well.
Oh, yeah. There's, yeah. Well, Zigbee, the underlying radio for Matter, or for Thread, let me put that, which is part of the formal Matter standard, is Zigbee. So, yes. And right now, this is going to run open Thread. We're not even going to get into that. It's just pretty cool. And they've got, you know, all the software. They put out a software toolkit so you can build easily on this, which is nice. Every chip maker pretty much has to do that now, because if your chip isn't easy to build on, no one's going to use it.
And PSA level 3 certified secure vault.
That's
the highest level of security certification for IoT devices.
That's right. This is ARM's PSA certification. They've got level 2, level 3. Basically, level 3 means you've got like a dedicated secure enclave on the chip. You do a lot of other things. And I've talked about the other things in previous podcasts, but this is good. And they recertified. Okay, so this is a pretty powerful piece of silicon, and I'm glad it's out, and I'm glad we're seeing this, because it means people today can test it and start putting it in their products by the time Matter is ready, hopefully by the middle of this year. Other news, also on the machine learning side, is Google has unveiled a Coral DevBoard Micro. And this is the first microcontroller-based Tiny ML board. And all right, so you know I was all excited about machine learning at the edge. That got a little song out of me. TinyML is machine learning on microcontrollers. That's how we define it here. Other people will call TinyML like machine learning on a phone, and I scoff at them. I say no.
No, that's not, yeah.
And this
that's,
is, that, yeah.
That's more like a full-size CPU processor with multiple cores. This is a, not to reuse it, but a microcontroller. I mean, it's a teeny tiny little board that's like 30 millimeters by 65 millimeters, and the chip is like not even half the size of a postage stamp.
Yeah, it's an M4 in a Cortex M7 low processor.
Power.
So super low power. So this is a big deal because Google has been doing a lot with edge computing. That's actually pretty edgy with their Coral boards, but this is the first one that's a microcontroller and super small and exciting for those of us who are like, Tiny ML is the way to go. So, yay, Google. We don't have pricing or availability yet on this. It's just coming soon, but look for it.
Real quick?
Yeah.
Just to put this in perspective, this teeny tiny chip that uses like practically, I don't want to say no energy, but it can do 2 trillion operations per second per watt. Wait, let me get that right. Yes. 2 tops per watt.
2 tops per watt?
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
Yes, it is.
Okay. I don't even know what to think about that. I mean, sorry.
Well, like with computers, I typically think like how many instructions, you know, per watt, how many clock cycles, et cetera. When you talk about like just even like a laptop computer, it's, you know, 30, 40, 45 watts to do X number of trillion operations per second. This does 2 trillion per watt.
Yeah. All right. Final new development board kind of chippy thing for you. There is a $10 RISC-V development board. And this is out of China. And it's looking to compete with Arduinos. But let's give you just a little background if you don't recall. RISC-V is an open source instruction set. An instruction set for a chip is like ARM. They make their own instruction set. That's those champagne grapes they license out to people. Intel has their x86 instruction set. So RISC-V is a new one. It's come out. It was created in 2012. And basically, I guess it's not new anymore. It's a decade old. Wow. But it's open source. So no one owns it. You can just build on it. And we're seeing a lot of real innovation here. And I'm really excited about it. So yeah, this is just a new $10 board that if you want to start playing with RISC-V.
This is good for prototyping and creating things, you know, on the cheap. This is not super powerful. You know, like has 64K of memory.
Yeah, 144
gig or 16. Yeah,
144 exactly. Megahertz clock speed. This is like a microcontroller. This is an Arduino.
Exactly. But the nice thing is, and you mentioned Arduino, I mean, it looks like an Arduino board. It has the similar pinouts for I/O, so you may be able to use compatible Arduino hats and peripherals and such. So it gives you another option, so you don't have to just go with an Arduino chipset and board.
Okay. And now we're done with all that stuff about chips. So if you were like, let's talk about Peloton.
Oh, let's. Because we're going to disagree on something here.
Oh, yeah, we are. Okay. So the big news this week was Peloton is temporarily, CNBC got documents from the company saying, hey, we're going to halt production of our connected fitness products, our bikes, our treadmills, our brand new product is going to be delayed. So it's basically nobody wants these anymore because the pandemic is over and everything that they've made.
Well, everybody who wants one can get one.
Right. Everybody who wants one has one. They're like, yeah. And so they're going to just pause their bike production for 2 months. It's already paused production of some of its other stuff. And everyone is freaking out. I don't know why everyone is freaking out. This feels pretty reasonable.
Because the growth has been off the charts for so long that it was just anticipated that people are just still going to want to shell out $2,000 for a bike or a treadmill and pay for services and such.
This is an example of the stock market just being silly. I'm just going to be... We knew that all good things come to an end, and you can't grow infinitely on the hardware side when your hardware is that expensive.
Correct. This is a limited demand market, so you have too much supply for it right now.
So this set off all kinds of shenanigans. Basically, people are like, one of the shareholders was like, oh, John Foley, the CEO, you got to get out of here. I don't think that's going to happen. And then everybody else was like, who should buy Peloton? Because clearly it's struggling because its stock price is down. And the biggest contenders was Apple. Everyone's like, Apple should buy Peloton because both of them are so good at integrating hardware and software, and Peloton's like an Apple experience. And I think this is just bonkers. And I'll say this because Apple makes hardware with a large potential market. They've already built a fitness service that I think will get better over time. Their strategy on all those fronts is to build and own the brains and then partner out with people to take advantage of those brains. So I can see Apple partnering with Peloton, but I don't see Apple buying Peloton because it doesn't need to sell bikes.
Well, right. Here's where I'm going to disagree a little. I don't necessarily disagree with your thought process there, but what Apple is good at is something we just talked about, and that is supply chain management. So they can fix Peloton's issues when it comes to predicting demand and so on. Additionally, I've tested the Apple Fitness Plus product, and it's quite good. And Apple does make, they're making far more on services than ever. You know, they're not just a hardware company. They're certainly not just a software company anymore. They are a services company, and they deliver an integrated experience with the hardware, the software, and the services. I don't know that I would see people shelling out the same amount of money for an Apple-built or Apple-designed Peloton bike or treadmill, but Apple's really good about making prices at least reasonable for what they offer, and having high profit margins on their side because of supply chain management. And when you add in the service integration, and there's no integration, there's no hardware integration with the Fitness Plus service right now, I think they could do something here. I don't think they could do it by purchasing the company at its current value. I think it would have to be at a discount. But I could see it. It's okay. We can disagree.
Oh, no, I know we can... Oh, I'm totally fine disagreeing with you, Kevin. I'm sighing because you're right. And there's the health and fitness market, like the gym market, for example, hotels, that sort of thing. And remember, Peloton bought Precor last year, I think. Was it last year? So they'd have extra manufacturing.
And potential at the lower end of the market, which is what Precor products were.
Precor are pretty high-end, I thought, for things like, they're the good ones for health clubs and that sort of thing.
Are they? They might be.
I feel like my Precor ellipticals were pretty, nice compared to, a Nordic Track or something.
Well, you know what? I just went to shop Precor on Google, and I could spend $5,000. So they're more in the Nordic Track price range, and Okay, all right, well, so scratch that, never mind.
Well, clearly neither of us are experts at fitness equipment because we're kind of...
Actually, Apple doesn't really make low-end devices and products anyway, so never mind.
Anyway, okay, so that's where Peloton is. And we're talking about this because Peloton is a connected bike. And I just want to say that putting smarts and stuff, there's such an opportunity there, but it's not magic. So, you know, I feel like there's a new market, and Peloton is still making money from annual subscriptions. So a benefit for them is that, yes, they've got this hardware on the market. It's not their fault that everybody pledged, you know, bid up their stock because they were so excited about the hardware opportunity, when the real opportunity is probably more around the constant subscriptions.
And we're actually a paying customer of one of those subscriptions, even though we have no Peloton hardware. My wife pays $12 or $13 a month for the digital classes, the same ones that you pay for when you buy a Peloton bike. But we bought like a $500, $600 bike that's good enough. And she just uses the iPhone or projects to the TV what the live class is or the recorded class. And she does her workout. And so that's a great opportunity for them.
Yeah. And you know how we always talk about like people buying connected hardware don't always understand that they're really buying software? Maybe people who buy connected hardware stocks don't understand they're really buying SaaS stocks, and that should be priced in. Okay. Hey, let's talk about new money for IoT tracking companies. We've got two. One, Tag and Track, adorable name. They launched out of stealth this week with $10 million in funding, led by Dell Technologies and Merck Global Innovation Fund, and AeroSafe Global participated. So Tag and Track is trying to, quote unquote, modernize logistics. And they have a bunch of different types of hardware that you can plop on your devices to, or plop on places to track things. The goal is visibility into this like global supply chain. So they've got printable hardware sensors and software that you tie to those sensors. And it just helps shippers and companies who are shipping stuff understand where their stuff is in the supply chain.
Interesting that they use Bluetooth. Oh, I was going to say, and not like LoRaWAN or something, but they do use cellular smart label technologies as well. So, okay.
Yeah. My hunch is most of their stuff is Bluetooth tags, and then it talks to a cellular gateway.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so, hey, asset tracking is still freaking huge. There's so many companies in this space, including Samsara, which went public last year. Also, Pebblebee, which is a name, is a blast from the past. They are an old school consumer smart tracking device and a button. I'll just say they make a button. They have raised just a little bit more money. Sources for GeekWire, so they looked at some documents from the Secretary of State and the SEC, says that Pebblebee has raised $5 million. And Pebblebee is 8 years old. They also hired a new CEO. And the goal here is to help basically make Pebblebee like a contender, I'm guessing. I mean, I really haven't heard about it for a while. It launched as both a tracker and a Bluetooth. It was a Bluetooth tracker and a Bluetooth button that talked to your phone.
Right. So you attach it to your keys or some other device like a Tile or an AirTag. It's less expensive than those because you can get a 2-pack at Costco for $30. But I wonder about the future. You can't rely on the older technology forever, you know? You need a network, you need new radio technologies and so on to compete now.
Yeah. Now, Pebblebee has sold more than 1 million devices, and it has more than 400,000 active customers. However, I don't know how many AirTags have been sold, but probably a lot.
Well, we'll never find out, but yeah. I can bet you it's more than 1 million.
So. Exactly.
I feel like I bought 100,000 myself, but I only bought a 4-pack. They're everywhere.
Are you using them all?
Yeah, we're finally using them all. Yes.
Oh, good.
Bags, keys, those are, and one wallet actually as well.
Nice. Yeah. Okay. New products. No, not new products. New takes on old products. Belkin.
that make the old products much better, apparently.
Yeah. Belkin updated its Wemo Stage Scene Controller, which when it launched, literally everyone hated because it didn't work well. But they've rolled out Thread as part of like updating it for Matter. And apparently people now like it.
Cause it works.
Thread made it work.
Yes, it's reliable and it's super fast. I mean, that's far better than I assume they had Bluetooth. Yeah. In the past. I mean, plus it's better battery life. You know, one review says on Bluetooth, we got 9 months on a battery, you know, and we should see far more than that, up to 2 years on average.
Yeah. Oh, so for those of y'all who are like, wait, what the heck is the Wiimo Stage Controller? I'm sorry. It looks like a Luchon Pico. It's a remote that you can store, like you can stick it on your wall or you can just stick it with adhesive to other stuff or just let it live in your house. So it's just a tiny little handheld remote to control your lights and scenes from your home.
It's like a programmable button in the shape of a very small candy bar with three buttons. So you can have six routines or scenes that are programmed, you know, for a single press, a double press, etc.
And so, yeah, now it's worth it. Go Thread.
Yay.
New products for everybody who's out there like me loving fancy lights. Philips Hue has new outdoor and indoor lights. And some of them are fancy.
Which one would expect from Philips Hue, especially on the outdoor side? They really do make some, I think, very attractive outdoor lighting.
They do. And they're bringing those fancy... I feel like stylistically, we're not that into filament bulbs anymore. Like that the filament bulbs are the ones that kind of glow in the clear glass bulbs.
Like an Edison bulb or something.
Thank you. I was like, what is the word? Yeah.
Yeah. We actually just added those to our kitchen, but okay.
Oh.
Well, only for three lights over the island because it just makes it a little more dramatic.
I'm just going to awkwardly pause here and say,
No, it's okay. It's okay. You don't watch Lord of the Rings. You don't like my filament lights, whatever.
I just, you know, they're a little 2010s to the 2020 kind of thing.
They're like with last French decade. Farmhouse look, okay?
Okay. Well, anyway, so they're bringing those outside. So if you're Kevin and you want outdoor filament bulbs that are remote controllable and, you know, part of the Philips
Hue, I wouldn't want them outside. That's just silly.
Oh, actually, I think they might be nice there. That gives you that.
Crying out loud.
Okay.
This is the show where we agree on nothing.
Oh, dear.
It's all good. It's all good. So $99 for these outside.
The bulbs? Oh, no, this is a full light. Sorry.
Yeah, no, this is a fixture.
These are all fixtures. Philips is really digging into this whole, like, they're like, yeah, bulbs are great, but let's talk fixtures.
Yeah, anybody can sell bulbs. We want to sell fixtures with bulbs.
And that makes sense. I mean, integrated, I'm shopping for lights for, we're finally tackling some more home renovation projects and most of the lights we find are now integrated, which is kind of a problem if you don't like the 3,000 degree Kelvin kind of cool daylight look, because they are everywhere. Anyway, okay. Philips Hue is also making a wall light for outside and a different wall light. And then they're bringing their Kala. They're called bollards. Just all those driveway lights or lights that you see along sidewalks that's what a bollard is, in case y'all don't know.
Like runway lights.
Runway lights, yeah. They're bringing that in stainless steel. It had been in black. And then Philips Hue is adding new effects for their scenes, and I'm really excited about this. They're going to add candle and fireplace. Ooh.
Well, you know, I kind of like that because for outdoor lights, you know, having a little candle flicker is kind of actually nice. I wouldn't have the fireplace one outside. I would do that with my indoor light.
Well, this will be through all their Philips lights, is my understanding. So we'll get them all across the board. So these are just software-based effects that you can apply to
your lights. That is correct, yes. So, all Philips Hue lights that are both Zigbee and Bluetooth compatible. Yes.
You could actually, because you've got those lights, the things that tie into your gaming system. What are the Hue Plays?
It is, the Sync.
Syncs. Maybe those will get it. You could have like a fireplace behind your television.
I mean, I'm really getting into the automated scenes with these because, you know, like I'll use the Aurora one, which is like Aurora Borealis.
And, yeah.
You know, I have the lights shifting slowly, like Northern Lights, well, Northern here anyway. And I really do like that. So, yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, that concludes the news for this week, but let's get to the Internet of Things podcast hotline. This is the segment of the show where we answer all your questions, and you can call us with those questions at 512-623-7424. And the IoT Podcast Hotline is brought to you by SpinDance. SpinDance is an IoT development shop that can help you design, build, and support your IoT product. You can learn more at spindance.com. Also, if you call us and leave a question, you will be entered to win a smart connected garage door opener. We'll either do a Chamberlain one or a Miros, which is HomeKit enabled. So you can choose. And speaking of choice, this week's question is actually deals with kind of the the not fun aspects of compatibility and too many choices and too many OSs for the smart home. So let's hear it.
Hi, Stacey and Kevin. This is Michael from Rochester, New York. I recently got one of the new-ish Google Nest thermostats, the one that connects to the Home app. And I'm wondering if there's a way to connect that thermostat to Madam A. Everything I see when I'm looking online just shows me the older learning thermostat that still uses the Nest app. I can't find anything that shows me how to connect my Nest thermostat to Madam A. And I don't really want this for voice commands. What I want this for is I have a Ring alarm system, and I'd like to set it up so that when my alarm gets set, my thermostat gets set into away mode. If I could run a routine to do something like that, and when I come home and disarm the alarm, my thermostat goes back to home mode. I know there's the home and away assistant with the thermostat already, but sometimes that takes up to an hour after I've already left the house where my house is being heated before it realizes I'm away, and then it turns itself to away mode. Any help on this would be greatly appreciated. I love the podcast. Keep up the good work.
Oh, Michael, when you started this question, I was like, oh no, you did the cardinal sin of IoT investing.
You pick a platform and stick with it.
Yeah, you purchased outside of your ecosystem.
Well, I mean, and that may change as we've talked about with Matter devices coming later this year. So we'll see some potential benefit there, maybe not on all older devices. That's the issue there.
Yeah, so here's what we have to tell you. One, Matter may not help you because Google, depending on how Google has said, it's only going to support Matter on some of its thermostats, and I'm not sure which one you have. You alluded to it being older. So Matter may not help you here. Other bad news we have to tell you is you cannot put a Google Nest product into a routine like you're trying to do. You can link your Nest thermostat to Madam A, though. So you can enable the Google Nest skill in Madam A. So you go to the Madam A app, and you can search for Google Nest, and that will come up. You will also need to, if you haven't already, upgrade from your Nest account, your original Nest account, to the Google Home account. People hate doing that, but you have to do that.
That migration is a hoo-ha and a half.
Yeah, nobody likes it.
Nope.
So you have to migrate if you haven't already. You have to go download the skill. Then you have to link your two accounts. Once you have done that, you can do voice control for setting thermostats. You cannot take your Ring alarm system and use that as a control, like as a trigger.
Like a trigger event.
To turn off your Nest. And the reason why your Nest may take so long is because Google has, to determine if someone is home or not, uses a bunch of different variables. And they've learned these over time. In pre-pandemic, I think the pandemic has messed with lots of learning algorithms because our habits utterly changed. But historically, Google was like, if you leave in the morning, it will rapidly decide that you're not home. If you leave at a different time, it'll take longer because it really wants to be sure that you're actually gone. When you left in the morning, it was basically like, oh, well, clearly this person's leaving for the day. Now it's less clear. So that's why it's taking so long.
But there is one thing you could look into that might speed up the whole process of your thermostat going to away mode. In the Nest app, you can enable Home Away Assist. That feature basically uses your phone's location to determine if you're really away from home. It's like geofencing. And even better, if you have multiple people in the house, you can invite all of them to the Nest account. They can be members, and it will use all their locations. So that way, if you leave and they're not members and they stay at home, you don't want that to go, the thermostat to go into away mode and they're freezing or sweating. It would actually kick into a different mode when the last person has left the geographic area with their phone. So that should help. It's not giving you precisely what you want, but it may accomplish a similar goal.
And if you're willing to, because you're in this ecosystem, you can actually, Amazon makes their own smart thermostat now, and it is $59.99. That means you do replace one thermostat with another, but it's relatively inexpensive. So if you're willing to do that, then you will all be, everything will be in the same ecosystem. And I don't know for sure because I haven't played with this thermostat. You should be able to include that in routines that will work.
If this Nest purchase was recent enough that you can return it and switch to Amazon's thermostat, I hate to say it, but that's probably the way I would go because of that Ring Amazon integration that's going to afford you different functionalities that you just can't have when you start mixing and matching platforms, unfortunately.
But Michael, it shouldn't have to be this way. And
I agree.
We think Matter's going to solve it for new purchases going forward and some existing purchases, but grr. So
yeah.
Sorry to, I don't know.
Rain on your parade.
Yeah. All right. Remember, if you would like us to rain on your parade, you can give us a call at 512-623-7424. And you will also be entered to win our monthly January drawing for a smart garage door opener. And that concludes this segment of the show, but please stay tuned for our guest, Oisin Hanrahan, who is the CEO of Angie. We're going to be talking about home improvement, the smart home, and what trade professionals want from smart home vendors. But first, a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is RightPoint. Hey everyone, we are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. And this week's sponsor is RightPoint. RightPoint is a global experience company on a relentless quest to make everything work better. And I have Andy Watson, an associate director of product management and the IoT lead from RightPoint with me here. He's ready to tell us a little bit about the work they do. So, Andy, I wanted to ask you, how is RightPoint making the Internet of Things work better?
Thanks, Stacey. At RightPoint, we start any conversation about IoT around the idea of the experience a device will deliver to the people who actually use it. It needs to fit seamlessly into their day-to-day lives and make life easier. As we know, IoT is an ever-evolving space, and we've been working for several years now to helping organizations strategize, concept, build, and launch their IoT products. One great example is our work with Chamberlain on their MyQ product.
Yes, we're very familiar with Chamberlain and the MyQ Smart Garage Controller here on the show. So what sort of work were you involved in?
We've partnered with Chamberlain for years, working across e-commerce and smart home infrastructure.
Ah, smart home infrastructure. Tell me a little bit more.
Back in 2017, when MyQ was really taking off, our team re-engineered the backend and the messaging engine to drive scalability and performance. Chamberlain was using an on-prem monolithic architecture, and we migrated them to an extensible microservices solution that set the platform up for scale, an architecture that allows for additional capabilities and service offerings.
Nice. So what's a good example of how Chamberlain's extended this system?
Amazon Key is a big one. It lets Amazon make deliveries inside your garage. MyQ Pet Portal is another interesting one. It's a smart dog door and won a CES Innovation Award.
Awesome. So if someone wants to find out more about RightPoint, where should they go?
You can learn more about RightPoint, our work with Chamberlain, and our IoT capabilities by Googling RightPoint IoT or visiting us at rightpoint.com/IoT. That's RightPoint.com/IoT.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and today's guest is Oisin Hanrahan, who is the CEO of Angie. Hello, Oisin, how are you doing today?
Great to talk to you, Stacey. Thanks so much.
Oh, I'm so excited. Is this the first time ever that y'all did a survey asking about home improvement and the smart home actually made the list of things people are willing to spend on?
It's not just the first time it's made the list. It's the first time it's made the list and it's in the top three. So before this, I guess you could say technically it made the list, but it was down at, you know, somewhere in the 70s, 80s, 90s. Certainly no part of the list that anyone wanted to talk about. Whereas now, the smart home, for the first time ever, it's not top 10. It's actually in the top three. And, you know, we're really excited about it. We think it speaks to a lot of what's going on out there in the world. You know, some part of me is surprised it wasn't there sooner. And then, you know, on the other hand, you're like, these things happen gradually and then suddenly. And it's it really does speak to the fact that people are changing their expectations of their home. And I think the pandemic has really accelerated that.
I will say so. I've spent a lot on smart home gadgets, although I always have. So before people, they're like, what? Who is this guy? What is happening with the smart home and how does he know about it? Why don't you introduce the concept of Angie? Because people may remember Angie's List, but they might need a little refresher on what y'all are doing now and how this all relates.
Sure. So Angie's List is about 20 years old. We recently rebranded it from Angie's List to Angie. And at Angie, we're all about helping people take care of their home. So it started 20 years ago with a list where you could go to look at the actual list that Angie herself put together of contractors near you. We've seen that people's expectations have changed. So Angie has changed from being a list into a place you go to actually book services, the same way that, you know, our expectations have changed to booking a car. And you know, we do that now through Uber or Lyft, or we order food through DoorDash or Postmates. And Angie's really changed to be a place you go to take care of your home. So today you can go to Angie.com or the Angie mobile app, and you can find a pro if you'd like. And that still exists there with great ratings, reviews across 250,000 pros. But as things have changed, we've also started allowing people to book services. So in the last quarter, we had people buy over $100 million of services directly from Angie, where, you know, you want to get a new light fitting installed, you want to get a new toilet installed, you want to get an apartment cleaned, you want to get your, you know, kitchen painted. You can actually just go directly to Angie and we'll quote you a price on the spot and we'll go and carry out the service for you. So Angie's all about helping people take care of their homes when their homes are more important than ever before. You know, I think we've seen through the pandemic that, you know, people have put this incredible focus on the home, this place of safety, this place of rest and relaxation. And now more recently, this place of work as well, as so many more people have started to work from home. And we think that's actually one of the main drivers of smart home going up the list to being one of the top three projects people are doing in their homes.
Got it. And we'll get to that in a second. But first, I want to tell people, because, you know, we all love lists. So the first thing that people are doing, the number one thing that people are doing with their home project in 2021, so last year, was interior painting. I just want to raise my hand and say I did that. Also, bathroom remodels and smart home, which is coming in third. So what are people talking about when they talk about smart home? Because that can cover everything from buying new connected appliances all the way to like screwing in some light bulbs.
Look, I think you're right. It's across the board. It's people thinking about their homes less as an economic investment, right? So, you know, when we've done the purpose of home projects and the reason behind them over the last, you know, number of years, we've seen everything, you know, focused primarily on economics. So people saying, hey, I'm trying to protect the value of my home. So I'm doing preemptive work to protect its value. Or they're saying, hey, I'm trying to like increase its value. I want to increase the equity in my home. So if I put in a new kitchen, I spend, you know, $10,000, $15,000 on a kitchen, I think it'll increase the value of my home by, you know, $20,000, $30,000. And we've seen that trend really flip in 2021, where people are starting to focus on home as I think it was originally intended, which is a place of rest, a place of relaxation, and a place, you know, more recently, a place of work. And they're thinking about the utility they derive from the home itself. So that's what we're seeing. We're seeing people really think about, okay, what's the utility that I can get out of my home? So as an example, you might not think that, you know, putting a thermostat, a time thermostat, or a, you know, a Wi-Fi enabled thermostat in your home is going to increase it by more than the, you know, few hundred bucks or, you know, $1,000 it's going to cost to install it and get it all set up, but it might increase your utility by a lot more than that. Because, you know, when you're away from your home and you're driving back, you can turn it on and you can you can make sure that it's accustomed to your schedule and it's setting the heat and cooling in your home to match your life. And the same is true of so many other things around the home, whether it be, you know, smart speakers, whether it's smart door locks, whether it's security systems, all these things we've just noticed, it's less about economic value. It's more about utility. It's more about people saying, this just makes my life better. This makes my home work for me. This setup works in a much more convenient way for me. And another, more recent example that we saw throughout the pandemic was the focus on connectivity and Wi-Fi. So people really saying, okay, well, yes, I bought, when I got my broadband, I got a Wi-Fi router with it. But that didn't really do what I wanted in my home. It didn't actually cover my whole home, or it didn't give me high speed in the, the work part of my home. And when I connected, 20 or 30 devices to it, all of a sudden it got really slow. And people have really invested in upgrading the Wi-Fi in their home and making sure that it's spread out in an appropriate way. And I think all those things together, it's just about how do you make your home work for you? And that's the theme we see coming through in this report. It's people making their home work for them.
Okay. So, and you've talked a lot about some of the reasons driving this. Hey, we're stuck in our homes. A lot of people got some money during the pandemic and were willing to put it towards renovations. I think working from home is another thing that people are trying to build out offices, or a lot of purchases revolve around lighting. So people look nice when they're zooming in on meetings. So what are you seeing between lifestyle choices and maybe work choices? Anything that sticks out for you?
Yeah, what's that phrase that the directors of photography say all the time? It's like light beats makeup. I think it's probably true on Zoom too, where people focus on light and then they start to focus on sound. So we've seen people really creating home office environments where they might not have an extra room, so they're using a hallway and they're putting up some soundproofing. They're investing in those sound suppression units that really create background noise. They're investing in Zoom lights. They're investing in, a fixed camera setup. And they're investing in perhaps like a fold-out desk that fits in a hallway or that fits in a nook in their room. And they're investing in, more and more what you would think of as like more permanent setup in which to work.
All right, let's flip the switch from people who are like buying this stuff to the people who are trying to install it. For years, people have reached out to me asking for me to come to their house to set up their smart home systems. And I can tell you, having been in this space forever, there's not a huge number of people who are able to do this. We saw Amazon get into this market with people who would come and install devices to work with the Amazon Echo speakers. We've seen some of the broadband players do this. But is there really a move by the trades to serve this market?
So I think you've seen two things happen. You've seen the basic items become, easier and easier to self-set up. And, that's great that, you can take out one item and plug it in and it'll just work right out of the box. I think we've got, some of the large electronic brands to thank for that, for, making it so that you can take your phone right out of the box, turn it on, it starts immediately. On the other hand, what you've seen is the more devices people put in their home, the more interconnectivity they expect between the devices. And that's still complicated. That's still hard. And when you think about certain pieces of hardware that were perhaps already tricky to install, and now you put a smart layer on top of them, that's extra hard, right? So, you think about smart locks. Most people aren't replacing the lock in their home, their front door lock themselves. They're probably getting a locksmith to do it. And then you layer on top of that the fact that this lock is supposed to be smart, needs to be Wi-Fi enabled. Instead of just being a mechanical lock, it needs power. It gets extra tricky. And then you say, well, actually, what I'd like it to do is I'd like it to automatically, whenever anyone engages the lock or disengages the lock, I'd like it to automatically trigger my Nest Cam to record a 30-second clip. That gets even trickier. And then you say, I'd like it to go even a step further. When someone engages the lock on the outside of the door and there's nobody inside the door, I'd like it to, crank down my thermostat, or turn off the heat in my thermostat for, 30 or 40 minutes. So it's the interconnectivity of all these things that makes it tricky and that for certain people may require the use of professional tradespeople.
All right. And while everyone hearing that, I just want to encourage everyone to install a smart lock on their own, because by gosh, my 12-year-old was doing it way back in the day, and it's not as hard as you might imagine. So go out, be bold. Barring that, there are plenty of things like, you know, wiring light switches. That's kind of a pain in the butt. And right now, I use like an electrician for this, or I had a plumber come and install a smart leak detection and water shutoff device. So it seems to span across a number of trades. And I don't know, do you see any of that consolidating, or do you see any interest in any players in this market to kind of create a new offering?
Look, what we see is people going out and not really thinking about this as building a smart home. They think about it as solving a particular problem or bringing a particular feature set or benefit to their home. And pros are really responding to that, right? So the pros that we engage with, they're typically responding to a customer need or a homeowner need that's saying, hey, what I really want done is, you know, this particular thing in my home. And maybe for certain, you know, pros, they see that as an entry point. And, you know, they then work into, you know, some of the broader themes that a homeowner might want. But most pros are just focused on, hey, if a homeowner has this particular problem, I'll help them solve it. And, you know, what we see is definitely an opportunity for, you know, the bundling of more and more smart home products together as people become more comfortable with the idea of transitioning to a smart home rather than just point solutions.
Let's take this from the other side. What would the professionals, what would they like to see from the device makers? What would make their lives a little bit easier?
I think that the one of the more frustrating things for a pro is if an individual homeowner buys a device and the pro shows up to install it and it's just not compatible with their home. You know, as people are retrofitting smart devices onto, you know, older and older homes, some level of education of the homeowner as to what can and can't be retrofitted onto more aged properties, I think is a common pain point. Another is, you know, this idea that everything's just going to work together. You know, I think, you know, for the better part of well over a decade at this point, we've been talking about the different smart home operating systems and how some of them work together with certain devices, some of them work together with other devices, but they don't all work in a super seamless, interoperable way. And I think that's, you know, again, a frustration point. And it's less that the pro is frustrated by it inherently. It's more that the pro has to educate the consumer, and the consumer may have, you know, already bought two or three different devices from, you know, two or three different home operating systems with an expectation that they're all going to join up, but then they don't. And the homeowner may be disappointed. And we've obviously made some strides in that direction with some of the systems being more interoperable, but I think we've definitely got a bit of runway left to go figure that out.
So I have to ask, because this seems like something you might know about, but you also might not know about, but the industry would love for you to know about it. Are you familiar with Matter, the protocol coming out that promises to solve some of those interoperability issues?
I am familiar with it. I'm not deeply familiar with its limitations. I know that we've been promised versions of this before, and I am cautiously optimistic that maybe we'll get at it this time. But I think it's a tough problem to solve, right? It's a tough problem to solve because the incentives are just not super aligned. You know, to a degree, there's an element of closed loop systems here where, you know, the walled garden has value, and certain device manufacturers want to keep the, you know, keep the walled garden in place. And I think we're always going to see that for certain devices. And, you know, I think we're getting better and better, and Matter perhaps is another step forward to try solve that. But I think it really is a challenge for us.
There you go. Everybody listening, we've got to make Matter work. This is our chance. All right. Well, Oisin, thank you so much for coming on the show this week. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Great to talk to you. Good luck with your own home renovation projects.
And that concludes this week's episode of the Internet of Things podcast. Please join us next Thursday, and don't forget to subscribe. And if you can't get enough IoT news, I would love for you to sign up at www.stacyoniot.com for our weekly IoT newsletter, where we explain all kinds of things that we don't even get to on the show. Once again, thank you for listening, and please subscribe.